Chapter 105. Mark Twain had a special fondness for cats. As a boy, he always owned one, and it generally had a seat beside him at the table. There were cats at Quarry Farm and at Hartford, and in the house at Reading there was a gray mother cat named Tammany, of which he was especially fond. Kittens capering about were his chief delight. In a letter to a Chicago woman, he tells how those of Tammany assisted at his favorite game. To Mrs. Mabel Larkin Patterson, in Chicago. Reading, Connecticut, October 2, 08. Dear Mrs. Patterson, the contents of your letter are very pleasant and very welcome, and I thank you for them, sincerely. If I can find a photograph of my Amity and her kittens, I will enclose it in this. One of them likes to be crammed into a corner pocket of the billiard table, which he fits as snugly as does a finger in a glove, and then he watches the game and obstructs it by the hour, and spoils many a shot by putting out his paw and changing the direction of a passing ball. Whenever a ball is in his arms, or so close to him that it cannot be played upon without risk of hurting him, the player is privileged to remove it to any one of the three spots that chances to be vacant. Ah, no, my lecturing days are over for good and all. Sincerely yours, S. 50. Clemens. The letter to Howells which follows was written a short time before the passage of the Copyright Extension Bill, which rendered Mark Twain's new plan, here mentioned, unneeded at least for the time. To W.D. Howells, in New York. Monday, October 26, 08. Oh, I say. Where are you hiding, and why are you hiding? You promised to come here, and you didn't keep your word.
This sounds like astonishment, but don't be misled by that.
Come, fire up again on your fiction mill, and give us another good promise. And this time keep it, for it is your turn to be astonished. Come and stay as long as you possibly can. I invented a new copyright extension scheme last Friday, and sat up all night arranging its details. It will interest you. Yesterday I got it down on paper in as compact a form as I could. Harvey and I have examined the scheme, and tomorrow or next day he will send me a couple of copyright experts to arrange about getting certain statistics for me. Authors, publishers, and the public have always been damaged by the copyright laws. The proposed amendment will advantage all three, the public most of all. I think Congress will pass it, and settle the vexed question permanently. I shall need your assent and the assent of about a dozen other authors. Also the assent of all the large firms of the 300 publishers. These authors and publishers will furnish said assent, I am sure. Not even the pirates will be able to furnish a serious objection, I think. Come along. This place seemed at its best, when all around was summer green. Later it seemed at its best, when all around was burning with the autumn splendors. And now once more it seems at its best, with the trees naked, and the ground a painter's palette. Yours ever, Mark. Clemens was a great admirer of the sea stories of W.W. Jacobs, and generally kept one or more of this author's volumes in reach of his bed, where most of his reading was done. The acknowledgement that follows was sent when he had finished Southavon. To W.W. Jacobs, in England. Reading, Conn, October 28, 08. Dear Mr. Jacobs, it has a delightful look. I will not venture to say how delightful, because the words would sound extravagant, and would thereby lose some of their strength, and to that degree misrepresent me. It is my conviction that Dialstone Lane holds the supremacy over all purely humorous books in our language, but I feel about Southavon as the Cape Cod poet feels about Simon Hanks. He Lord knows all things, great and small, with doubt he's not perplexed. 'Tis him alone that knows it all, but Simon Hanks comes next. The poet was moved by envy and malice and jealousy, but I am not. I place Southavon close up next to Dialstone, because I think it has a fair and honest right to that high position. I have kept the other book moving. I shall begin to hand this one around now.
and many thanks to you for remembering me. This house is out in the solitudes of the woods and the hills, an hour and a half from New York, and I mean to stay in it winter and summer the rest of my days. I beg you to come and help occupy it a few days the next time you visit the U. S.S. Sincerely yours, S50. Clemens. One of the attractions of Stormfield was a beautiful mantle in the billiard room, presented by the Hawaiian Promotion Committee. It had not arrived when the rest of the house was completed, but came in time to be set in place early in the morning of the owner's 73rd birthday. It was made of a variety of Hawaiian woods, and was the work of a native carver, F.M. Atremba. Clemens was deeply touched by the offering from those Eastern Isles, the memory of which was always so sweet to him. To Mr. Wood, in Hawaii, November 30, 08. Dear Mr. Wood, the beautiful mantle was put in its place an hour ago, and its friendly loa was the first uttered greeting my 73rd birthday received. It is rich in color, rich in quality, and rich in decoration, therefore it exactly harmonizes with the taste for such things which was born in me, and which I have seldom been able to indulge to my content. It will be a great pleasure to me, daily renewed, to have under my eye this lovely reminder of the loveliest fleet of islands that lies anchored in any ocean, and I beg to thank the committee for providing me that pleasure. Sincerely yours, S50. Clemens. XLVII, Letters, 1909. To Howells and Others. Life at Stormfield. Copyright Extension. Death of Jean Clemens. Clemens remained at Stormfield all that winter. New York was 60 miles away, and he did not often care to make the journey. He was constantly invited to this or that public gathering, or private party, but such affairs had lost interest for him. He preferred the quiet of his luxurious home with its beautiful outlook, while for entertainment he found the billiard afternoon sufficient. Guests came from the city, now and again, for weekend visits, and if he ever was restless or lonely he did not show it. Among the invitations that came was one from General O.O. Howard asking him to preside at a meeting to raise an endowment fund for Lincoln Memorial University at Cumberland Gap, Tennessee. Closing his letter, General Howard said, "Never mind if you did fight on the other side." To General O.O. Howard. Stormfield, Reading, Connecticut, Jan. 12, 09. Dear General Howard, you pay me a most gratifying compliment in asking me to preside, and it causes me very real regret that I am obliged to decline, for the object of the meeting appeals strongly to me, since that object is to aid in raising the $500,000 endowment fund for Lincoln Memorial University. The endowment fund will be the most fitting of all the memorials the country will dedicate to the memory of Lincoln, serving, as it will, to uplift his very own people. I hope you will meet with complete success, and I am sorry I cannot be there to witness it and help you rejoice. But I am older than people think, and besides I live away out in the country and never stir from home, except at geological intervals, to fill leftover engagements in Mesozoic times, when I was younger and indiscreeter. You ought not to say sarcastic things about my hiding on the other side. General Grant did not act like that. General Grant paid me compliments. He bracketed me with Xenophon, it is there in his memoirs for anybody to read. He said if all the Confederate soldiers had followed my example and adopted my military arts he could never have caught enough of them in a bunch to inconvenience the rebellion. General Grant was a fair man and recognized my worth, but you are prejudiced and you have hurt my feelings. But I have an affection for you, anyway. Mark Twain. One of Mark Twain's friends was Henniker Heaton, the so-called aether of penny postage between England and America. When, after long years of effort, he succeeded in getting the rate established, he at once spent his energies in the direction of cheap cable service, and a letter from him came one day to Stormfield concerning his new plans. This letter happened to be overweight, which gave Mark Twain a chance for some amusing exaggerations at his expense. To Henniker Heaton, in London. Stormfield, Reading, Connecticut, January 18, 1909. Dear Henniker Heaton, I do hope you will succeed to your heart's desire in your cheap cablegram campaign, and I feel sure you will. Indeed, your cheap postage victory, achieved in spite of a quarter century of determined opposition, is good and rational prophecy that you will. Wireless, not being as yet imprisoned in a Chinese wall of private cash, and high placed and formidable influence, will come to your aid and make your new campaign briefer and easier than the other one was. Now then, after uttering my serious word, am I privileged to be frivolous for a moment? When you shall have achieved cheap telegraphy, are you going to employ it for just your own selfish profit and other people's pecuniary damage, the way you are doing with your cheap postage? You get letter postage reduced to 2 cents an ounce, then you mail me a 4-ounce letter with a 2-cent stamp on it, and I have to pay the extra freight at this end of the line. I return your envelope for inspection. Look at it. Stamped in one place is a vast, and under it the figures 0, and under those figures appears a sinister and suspicious and mysterious 50. In another place, stamped within a circle, in offensively large capitals, you find the words UE 8 cents. Finally, in the midst of a desert space up, nor stirred from that circle, you find a figure 3 of quite unnecessarily aggressive and insolent magnitude, and done with a blue pencil, so as to be as conspicuous as possible. I inquired about these strange signs and symbols of the postman. He said they were P.O. Department signals for his instruction. Instruction for what? To get extra postage. Is it so? Explain. Tell me about the large T and the 40. It's short for take 40, or as we postmen say, grab 40, go on please, while I think up some words to swear with. Do 8 means, grab 8 more. Continue. The blue pencil 3 was an afterthought. There aren't any stamps for afterthoughts. The sums vary, according to inspiration, and they whirl in the one that suggests itself at the last moment. Sometimes they go several times higher than this one. This one only means hog 3 cents more. And so if you've got 51 cents about you, or can borrow it, tell me. Who gets this corruption? Half of it goes to the man in England who ships the letter on short postage, and the other half goes to the P.O.O. D to protect cheap postage from inaugurating a deficit. I can't blame you. I would say it myself in your place, if these ladies were not present. But you see, I'm only obeying orders. I can't help myself. Oh, I know it. I'm not blaming you. Finally, what does that 50 stand for? Get the money, or give him 50. It's English, you know. Take it and go. It's the last cent I've got in the world, after seeing the Oxford pageant file by the grandstand. Picture after picture, splendor after splendor, 3,500 strong, the most moving and beautiful and impressive, and historically instructive show conceivable. You are not to think I would miss the London pageant of next year, with its shining host of 15,000 historical English men and women dug from the misty books of all the vanished ages, and marching in the light of the sun all alive, and looking just as they were used to look. Mr. Lascelles spent yesterday here on the farm, and told me all about it. I shall be in the middle of my 75th year then, and interested in pageants for personal and prospective reasons. I beg you to give my best thanks to the Bath Club for the offer of its hospitalities, but I shall not be able to take advantage of it, because I am to be a guest in a private house during my stay in London. Sincerely yours, S50. Clemens. It was in 1907 that Clemens had seen the Oxford pageant during the week when he had been awarded his doctor's degree. It gave him the greatest delight, and he fully expected to see the next one, planned for 1910. In the letter to Owls which follows, we get another glimpse of Mark Twain's philosophy of man, the irresponsible machine. To W.D. Owls, in New York. Stormfield, Reading, Con. Comma January 18, 09. Dear Owls, I have to write a line, lazy as I am, to say how your Poe article delighted me, and to say that I am in agreement with substantially all you say about his literature. To me his prose is unreadable like Jane Austen's. No, there is a difference. I could read his prose on salary, but not Jane's. Jane is entirely impossible. It seems a great pity that they allowed her to die a natural death. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.